We were fundraising for a year with no success. And then like in 3 days on the crowdfunding campaign, we raised £850,000 from 900 people on the internet.
Pierre Hazelier, who is the co-founder and CEO of the award-winning company Nopla, and who are a pioneering company that develops sustainable packaging alternatives made from seaweed and plants. They won the 1 million Earthshot prize in the Builder Waste category in 2022, and they've replaced over 21.5 million single-use plastic items across Europe, used by major brands like Lucozade, Decathlon, Compass Group, Just Eat.
You forced innovation and creativity, but also created competition in your own industry.
Yeah, and like we really invite competition, because I think if we are alone, it's actually a bad sign. It means that like no one really sees that it's kind of like an exciting, juicy market. First of all, I think it's just like we had the opportunity to do the co-CEO thing. Most startups don't. As soon as you're kind of like raising investment, the number one thing that happens is like the angel or the kind of like VC who writes the first check wants a very canonical structure of governance. It's quite funny how VCs pride themselves of being the kind of like custodian of innovation and scaling innovation, when actually they want really innovative products or business models, but they like very traditional funding model, they like very traditional governance model. So it's like, be innovative, but only in a certain kind of like place. I think to date, with I guess all rounds combined around like £35 million that we've raised.
How do you handle the pressure of raising that much?
Thank you very much. Really great to get the chance to chat and dissect some of these things. And actually, like, excitingly, the updated number is 30 million single-use plastics replaced, so keeps on growing.
Wow. what is the, is it 100 million that you're trying to get to, or what is the actual moonshot? I'm curious.
I think when we reach a billion, we'll have kind of like done a good job. But like, obviously it's already a very exciting number because it's an industrial scale number. Like, I think plastic is on another scale. We know that like it's still a drop in the ocean compared to plastic, but it's starting to count.
Yeah, it is, and it's progress. It's progress, which is kind of what is needed in reality. And I was thinking about your, obviously, your pedigree, what you do now. I was curious, if I also went back to the younger version of you, like, what would I find? What kind of kid or personality traits did you have that have brought you to where you are right now?
I think that I've always been very curious. My mom usually says that like I was always asking why about everything to the point that it was driving her mad. And I also kind of like, I think got like the chance of being exposed to lots of stuff. My parents being quite creative. And so there was always a lot of kind of like room for, like if you're interested about something, just getting kind of like a chance of really kind of like going deep, whether it's like activities or just kind of like trying to build stuff, explore in nature. So a very, very kind of like lucky level of exposure to lots of things to trigger imagination. I also played a lot with Legos. I think that I must have kind of like been a good kind of like training for thinking of like building stuff from scratch. Remember, like one of my first kind of like obsession was dreaming of building a vacuum cleaner for robot for Legos, so that you would actually kind of like get all the pieces really quickly, kind of like out of the floor. Because as we all know, like it's fun to play with Legos, but it ends up everywhere. And my grandma was always saying like, "Oh, you're gonna be an inventor," and so on. So I think I was encouraged in all these traits, which is nice.
Did you believe that statement around you were going to be an inventor from when you were young, or were you just like, you're just saying that?
I think when I was young, for sure. And then I think when it came to kind of like choose a bit like education path, I had still kind of like this interest in like creating physical products and creating new solutions and innovation, but that's not something that you cannot like can study straight away. So I followed the really good advice from someone in the kind of like art and creative like world, that it was much easier to actually start with a technical background, and then you could make the bridge towards kind of like more innovation, design, and creativity. So I did an engineering degree, which in France is like a 5-year master's kind of like in material science. And it was a bit of a kind of like log, a bit frustrating to kind of like spend a lot of time with like very theoretical and quite abstract things. But I think it's actually served me well of having that, like the engineering rigor and the like ability to interface with quite a lot of kind of like scientific fields. And then after that, I actually went to kind of like work as a plastics packaging engineer, making lots of single use plastics with L'Oreal, the cosmetic brands. But after a couple of years of this, I was feeling frustrated about kind of like what my contribution was really kind of like to society. It was not something I was personally kind of like so passionate about. And so I got the chance of actually going back to study innovation in London, a master's called Innovation Design Engineering between the Royal College of Art and Imperial College. And I think that was really the moment where all of these things that were kind of interestingly came together, because it was kind of like this intersection of art, science, creativity, technology, with people who had like very different backgrounds. And that's where I met my co-founder, and that's really where I've enjoyed the most myself in kind of like studying and kind of like education.
Wow. The two things that you mentioned that kind of got me thinking, how did you have the patience to be able to still stay for those 5 years doing something technical, especially as a creative? Because I know you just said like it was hard, but I'm like, you'd be going absolute crazy. Like, how did you navigate that for 5 years and be like, I know why I'm doing this, and just stay in that path?
I think like I actually didn't know what I was kind of like doing. So I think that like there wasn't a big master plan, which maybe makes it kind of like easier to kind of like endure, because it's not like you have like a grand plan. You're just kind of like walking forward. I think the unfortunate thing about the French system is if you're good in math and physics, that's kind of like the straight line for you. You just go into kind of like engineering. And so in a way that was like, not that it was the default, but it was relatively kind of like there was a flow, which means that like I went with the flow. It was still kind of like a lot of like studying and hard work and so on. There were a few kind of like sweeteners. I mean, like it's like going to uni, there's lots of kind of like really cool people that you're meeting, and like there's a social element that like makes it a bit more kind of like interesting. And I think also they were kind of like, it was a big like engineering school, so there was a design program which was elective, but I was kind of like doing that and really enjoying that. So they were little kind of like tasters of other things, which I think were a way of keeping going. And I had the chance of going for 1 year abroad in Australia, where I think I learned a lot about life, but I didn't learn a lot about engineering. But that was like a really good kind of like year abroad of kind of like not being eating math and physics and material kind of like science every day either. So yeah, I found a way to cope throughout.
And something that you said earlier as well, you were thinking around what, when you're at L'Oreal, like what impact am I having on the world? I'm assuming at this time you're probably early 20s. I don't know that many 20-year-olds who are thinking about the impact they're having in the world, and they're thinking about either can I have a good time, how much money am I making, what does the future look like? So how come you're thinking about the impact you're having in the world at that point in time?
I think there was the impact in the world, but like mostly there was the impact on me. Like, yes, it was a well-paying kind of like job, and yes, it was kind of like a established company. I think my kind of like my grandparents clearly understood what I was doing, and that it felt like it was the kind of like ticking the box kind of like job. But the way L'Oreal was back then was very kind of like French, kind of like structured. So your job spec stops here and the job spec of the next person starts here, and you don't you dare kind of like challenging the way we do things and so on. So there was this element which was a bit frustrating. I really didn't care about cosmetics, so there was no kind of like real passion for kind of like any of the content of what we were creating. And I think that like I still had at the back of my mind this kind of like interest in creatively solving some bigger problems that feel a little bit more existential. So I think some people wait kind of like 10 years in the workforce before having like the need for more purpose. For me, I think it hit quite early on, and I was like, okay, like I don't want to be like, I see this as kind of like potentially the kind of like the golden shackles of a very nice lifestyle, and you could easily kind of like get stuck in there. And so leaving within 2 years was kind of like the moment to take the exit before you're kind of like stuck for another 20.
When you decided to leave and go study at Royal College of Arts, what did your parents, your grandparents say? Were they like, yep, go for it? Or were they like, what are you doing? Like, you're leaving a stable, secure place to go and do what exactly? How was that conversation like?
I think my parents were very supportive because like they know me well. I think it's funny, like, I think my grandma for kind of like the following 2 years, I think she still thought that I was working at L'Oreal. understand that, like, that was this weird thing that I would do in kind of like in the UK. But like generally, like I was like a lot happier. I was doing some really like cool stuff, meeting cool people. So I think it was not so much of a kind of like shock to people that that was something worth doing. I think it was a bit weird going back in terms of kind of like comfort of life, because like from earning kind of like a pretty decent salary to going back to being a student, being kind of like sharing a flat, being quite lean. But at the same time, it was, yeah, like as I said, it was like probably the most enjoyable 2 years of education I've ever experienced, and certainly like extremely formative years for me. So it was like, it was a really amazing experience.
You mentioned you met your co-founder there. Was that the same co-founder that you co-founded Gravity, Sketchwidge, and Skipping Rocks as well?
Yeah, so it was all the kind of like same classmates who ended up kind of like, this ended up being a bit of an incubator for kind of like quite a few projects. So with Rodrigo, we were kind of like working together on Skipping Rocks, which was the placeholder name that we started the company with before we rebranded into Notplug when things got a bit more established. But there was a third co-founder as well, who also was a co-founder of Gravity Sketch, along with like two other co-founders on Gravity Sketch. So we were kind of like a group of friends doing probably like too many projects in parallel. So there was a little bit of time to distill what people want to do kind of like for the long term. So essentially kind of like it became clear to me that like the thing I was really kind of like passionate about was the opportunity of creating those alternatives to single-use plastics. And so like the other co-founders like continued to push Gravity Sketch. It's still doing very well, and it's like a project that I'm super proud of having been kind of like in the early days kind of like working on. But at some point you have to make some choices, and I think that was the choice that like that feels right.
That is one thing that I know a lot of founders, entrepreneurs, people in general struggle with, is knowing what direction to take. And you had these two things of like, those not Gratis Sketch was like one of the first consumer detailed 3D printers that you created. And they've now got Rock Labs, which is again, sustainable packaging. And how did you, what helped you make the decision as to where you could turn to? Because I know there's so many people who want to be like, how do I choose? I've got so many ideas. What do I know where to go? So what did you do that was helpful for you that might be able to help other people as well?
I don't know if there's like some great kind of like lessons to be taught from that phase. I think in Gravity Sketch, we were kind of like very similar, like all the founders had very similar backgrounds. And I think that like, it was just making sense that like there would be like a bit of a split in terms of some really kind of like doubling down on the project and others kind of like going and doing something else. And then I think it's just like, yeah, for a year and a half, I think we achieved very little in terms of kind of like consistent progress by being constantly switching between one or the other. I think at some point it's worth committing to one thing. At the same time, like, we had the luxury of kind of like doing this. I think there's some people who are maybe like holding a side gig and waiting to go full time on it. And like, I don't think that like there is only one way. Like, it's not like you have to drop everything and go and like go full time. I think it's a luxury sometimes that some people have. Others are very successful just waiting for kind of like the minimum traction to then be able to make that decision. For us, it just worked, I think, to really accelerate things by dedicating 100% of our time on this. But as you like, it's very hard to find like co-founders because you're kind of like really in it for the long run. And I'm incredibly lucky of kind of like doing this with Rodrigo. And I think that like, it all depends on like who you're with in that journey and how you both feel at that time. The timing is everything, so you have to be aware of those elements as well. You're not in control of everything.
How do you find good co-founders? What are the key things that you look for? Obviously, you were in this incubator-esque kind of space, so you have some amazing people around you with similar ideas. But what are the key things, in your opinion, that are important when you're looking for a co-founder?
I think it's the most kind of like mysterious, non-like logic thing ever. And it's not like I really chose my co-founders. I think it's just that it happened the way it happened. Those projects happened around people, and that's how things got shaped up. With Rodrigo, we're not only co-founder, but we're co-CEO as well, which is getting a lot of kind of like momentum at the moment. But we've been co-founders and co-CEOs for kind of like over 10 years now. And that's something that I think when it works extremely well. But when it doesn't work, it's basically kind of like kiss of death for startups. And I think finding someone that you can be co-CEO with, that's like even harder than like finding co-founders. And I have zero like wisdom to share apart from you'll only know once shit hits the fan and like the hard times come, how the others behave. And that's kind of like the moment where you know. Before that, on paper, it could look great. You could have all the greatest feelings, and it's just kind of like only through adversity that you realize that you have the ability to be stronger together, to kind of like listen to each other, find a quick path to resolution of any kind of like thing that requires alignment. But at the same time, it's good to have a little bit of diversity of opinion so that you're coming up with better decisions. And the fine tuning of all of this, it's a bit of a magic trick, and I don't think that it can be engineered too much.
Why did you decide to go down the co-CEO route? I know a number of companies in France in particular have two co-founders. Which I just found out recently, actually, it was quite normal there. But from your perspective, obviously, you're in a different country at that time, but why did you decide to go down that route? Because like you said, it makes it so much more complex to make choices and decisions and move at speed and scale when you're trying to do something different.
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I think it's just like we had the opportunity to do the co-CEO thing. Most startups don't. As soon as you're kind of like raising investment, the number one thing that happens is like the angel or the kind of like VC who writes the first check wants a very canonical structure of governance. So it's going to be like, okay, one of you is going to be the CEO, one of you is going to be the CTO, which one is which? And I think that this, while a proven model in the past, is not the only model to create kind of like successful companies. And what was really kind of like amazing in our journey is that we didn't manage to raise money initially from angels or from like traditional investors. So we went the crowd, like equity crowdfunding way, where we had 900 investors from all around the world who kind of like put £10 and more to make this kind of like first round a reality. And as a result, no one represented a significant share of kind of like of the cap table. And that meant that for the first kind of like year and a half, we could deploy that money without a board, without having to kind of like be forced into that conversation. And I think for us, we would walk away from this company if we were forced into having to kind of like go like a different model. The model that works for us really well is the co-CEO model. And I have a ton of respect for people who are solo founders. I could not do it. I think it's just too much in one brain to have to deal with every single decision without having a peer kind of like to bounce it. And so for us, that's just kind of like that's what works for us. And having that chance of deploying money, creating value, and convincing the next guys who came after to invest on top of this that this was the right model was a real chance. I think it's almost the untold kind of like best thing about equity crowdfunding campaigns is, yes, sure, you get money from kind of like the internet, but like this freedom of deploying capital in a way that is not shaped by VCs was super defining for us, because from then on we didn't really get challenged on that model much more, because it was working. We had a track record for it, so we're really glad that that was our first round, that it was done that way, and I think that it's proven that it's worked in our case.
It sounds like there's something around both you and your co-founder that also says, one, you have to have that complete alignment and that trust in each other. Because after trying to raise and not being successful from VCs or angels, it's very easy for somebody to be like, okay, it might be because of our model. Let's change things. Or you're like, nope, this is who we are. We are, interesting enough, pushing the boundaries on so many different levels. Let's go for a different source and raise that way. So you both had to have that agreement and be like, this is why we're doing what we're doing, which I guess made a massive difference to your journey and your story.
Yeah, and I think it's quite funny how VCs pride themselves of being the kind of like custodian of innovation and scaling innovation, when actually they want really innovative products or business models, but they like very traditional funding model, they like very traditional governance model. So it's like be innovative, but only in a certain kind of like place. I don't think that innovation really works that way. I think that like changing and challenging these things is a good thing, and I think that like equity crowdfunding campaigns are also a very interesting funding mechanism that tends to allocate resources to projects that would have failed to raise from traditional investment kind of like mechanisms. I'm not saying that it's better or perfect, but I think it's very kind of like valuable to have that diversity. And I think that like same for the governance. I think it's quite cool that people are playing around with the classic governance model and testing things that are a little bit more kind of like a bit different, and some things work better for some cases, but like I think it's good to have a range.
Did you always know that you both had something great here? Therefore, when you got the rejections from not raising first time around, you still had the willingness to keep on going and obviously do the equity raise, because it's very easy to be like, oh, the market doesn't want this, the market's not responding to this, therefore let's pack it in and go into something completely different.
I think, I mean, like, there's been lots of moments of kind of like wavering in the faith that we had something, but I think deep down we really believe that there was something super exciting and interesting there. Probably not with the whole range of products we're doing today, and like maybe to the level of kind of like impact that we are aiming for today. I think it keeps on kind of like growing in ambition, which is cool, but. And I think we were very naive, and I think it's a very important kind of like quality that like founders need to be naive enough to kind of like jump in the kind of like hot seat for 10 years before things really kind of like have a chance of being at scale. But I think that like, yeah, there was definitely one particular moment. I think it was like 2.5 years in where there was little traction, there was very little kind of like signs from investors that they were going to kind of like write a check. And at that point, like my parents were paying my rent. I think that we had a bit of a conversation. Okay, clearly there's maybe an endpoint to this. We've got to kind of like maybe kind of like reassess how we're thinking this. And that created actually like a little bit the deadline for the crowdfunding campaign. I think we were not considering crowdfunding campaign as a first option. We were kind of like really thinking that like a VC or like angels would come through, but we were forced into crowdfunding campaign because we had no other kind of like mechanism. And the funny thing is, I think we were fundraising for a year with no success, and then like in 3 days on the crowdfunding campaign, we raised £850,000 from 900 people on the internet. So it was night and day, and that's been a formative experience as well. That like, it's not because people are saying no that like it's not working. It's just that like, you're not getting the yes from the right people.
And that's that. I was in a meeting yesterday or a workshop yesterday, and I was talking about, as a founder, you need to have the tenacity where recognizing it's a roller coaster, and there are times when it's all about timing, and there are times when you just need to figure out a different way of approaching things. And for you to be like, okay, well, we're forced into this, but actually it helped validate the idea. It helped validate the idea of co-founders. Mm-hmm. And then you can run and really establish yourself, because going from raising that through equity to then raising what, over 60 million to date, is miles and worlds like apart. But it all started with you being like, okay, rejection, what else can we do, because we're running out of time. So that's such a brilliant story. Like when I look at the history of how you both have got here to what you're doing right now.
And I think that like these things come in waves, and like now we've been, I guess, around the block long enough that we've seen a few kind of like different scenarios. So yeah, like I think to date, with I guess all rounds combined, around like £35 million that we've raised, there's been moments where like you're not even in fundraising mode, and people approach you because they're really excited about how they can accelerate the kind of like the growth and the impact that you can have. And so you're almost kind of like just like doing this ad hoc because it sounds like a really, really great path to kind of like accelerate. And there's other moments where it's like super difficult. No one wants to kind of like fund things that are hard to do, even if it's an inevitable kind of like transition that is needed to kind of like move away from single use plastics. And yet there's just kind of like no real kind of like leadership or kind of like backbone in the funding environment. So those things are entirely out of your hands. That's the market just kind of like being extremely reactive to macro kind of like data points, and your agency is very minimal. And I think it's almost kind of like reassuring sometimes to know that like it's not just down to you pitching very well, or kind of like having excellent metrics from the last kind of quarter, or having incredible technology, building an amazing team. It's also just all the things you don't control, and for that there's no, you have to accept that you don't control everything.
How do you handle the pressure of raising that much? Say 35 million today. Obviously, you had that landmark 20 million Series A raising in 2024 as well. Do you feel the pressure at all? Or is it just, okay, great, we've got the money. We still know what we're trying to do, what we're trying to achieve. That's why we got it. And you just carry on as business normal, business as usual.
For many years now, we have a very established board. And like for sure, there is kind of like a pressure. And I think like it's healthy. Like you don't perform as well if you don't have kind of like pressure and oversight. So I think there's a healthy level of pressure, and then there's moments where it's like unhealthy because it paralyzes you, and therefore you need to find coping mechanism to actually kind of like do a good job, because otherwise you're just kind of like running around like a headless chicken. I think again, like on the day to day, the relationship with my co-founder Rodrigo is the number one kind of like way to balance the pressure, and I think that's kind of like worked really well for each other. I think he would say the same thing. And I think like another thing is knowing that you're working on something that is kind of like worthwhile. We're here because we really believe that like plastic in nature is an issue that needs resolving. So even if you're getting a lot of no's or a lot of kind of like challenges, it still makes it a worthwhile thing to do. I think if you're developing an app for cats, maybe it's like a hard thing to convince yourself that it's kind of like critical that the world has this kind of like solution. But at the same time, yeah, like I think there's no downplaying that like it's a stressful lifestyle. It's not for everyone. There's a lot of kind of like Hollywood portraying of like the founder status being very kind of like exciting and something aspirational, but like, it's not that nice on the day to day. We don't do it for expecting it to be nice. I think we do it because it's it's exciting to have the chance of shaping things, seeing that the industry is kind of like changing and having the like the control of the direction of kind of like deploying some money towards those new technologies. That's all kind of like extremely rewarding, but we don't do it to have kind of like a chill life or be comfortable.
Speaking of the realities of being a founder, I'm actually curious. I was like, man, I'm glad to ask you that question properly. You talked about the Hollywood portrayal of being a founder, which is, seems like the champagne lifestyle, living by the beach, enjoying yourself, especially when you're at a particular level. The realities are very, very different. From your perspective, what are the real realities of being a founder so someone can really understand, like, this is the world that you're stepping into?
I think like every quarter has been different. It keeps on changing. And it's almost like once you figure out something, it's changing again and you have to figure it out again. Which is kind of cool. That's the thing that like also interests me. But I think that like being comfortable with a lot of uncertainty, like getting used to not knowing whether things are going to work out and still having to make those calls, that's something that is quite kind of like tiring in the long run. And so I think that, yeah, it's important to kind of like know how to recharge the batteries to be able to kind of like go through a lot of decision making without losing the ability to kind of like see the big picture. There's still a fair amount of like champagne moment, and like it's just at those moments that's when you need to network, that's when you need to be kind of like sharp, know how to kind of like pitch in 30 seconds, because that's when you connect with people that can open doors for you. So it's kind of like you never switch off. And in a way, if you really love what you do, that's actually not that hard, but it means that you never switch off.
At Nopla is the first and only seaweed based coating to fully comply with the EU single use plastic directive and be truly like properly plastic free. Obviously you got the official government certification. When you achieved that certification, was that one of the proudest moments that you and Rodrigo have had since you actually started the company?
Yeah, that was actually kind of like a crazy process. Because it was completely uncharted territory, because before that, no government had really kind of like tried to police the plastic-free versus kind of like actual plastic space. There were lots of companies that were just happily greenwashing by marketing those claims without having ever to prove themselves. And so there was no real kind of like process to know what the government was going to look at to be able to kind of like make their decision. And so the Dutch government put together a task force and essentially kind of like started to go in the market, pick up samples, send it to different labs, run different tests. It was a complete black box. And so it was really interesting, but also kind of like quite unnerving to not know what kind of like was going to be their decision factor. And we would have once in a while like a call with the kind of like the guy who was running this this task force, and we would try very kind of like nicely and subtly to ask questions back. He was like, no, I'm the one asking the question. And he was like, only one way. And so he was running through a process where you don't know what is going to be their assessment criteria. And obviously for us, it was quite defining, because like our name is Nopla. We really believe in kind of like this distinction between natural polymers and plastic polymers. So to have that not validated by kind of like the government who's starting to look at this in detail was a bit of a kind of like a defining kind of like identity moment. And so when eventually we came kind of like through the process with that decision that came that we were kind of like indeed plastic free, and that they hadn't at that point kind of like found anything else that was plastic free on the market, that was kind of crazy. And to me, it was just speaking about the lack of incentive for the industry, because up until that point, why would you bother raising kind of like and deploying tens of millions of pounds to develop a new material when you can just call the old materials plastic free and no one is going to go and challenge you? And I think since then, we've seen a radical kind of like acceleration in the development of new natural polymers on the market, because now there's a price that you can really differentiate yourself from all of the other plastics, and the market wants this kind of like distinction. So it's also kind of like quite interesting to see sometimes the unintended consequences of like the industry and the kind of like policy makers not enforcing their legislation. You can say, oh, like plastic is bad, but if you never check what is plastic, you're never going to have the industry come up with something better, because why would they bother?
So you forced, for want of a better word, innovation and creativity, but also created competition in your own industry.
Yeah, and like we really invite competition, because I think if we are alone, it's actually a bad sign. It means that like no one really sees that it's kind of like an exciting, juicy market. And so for a long time we were alone, because I think that like it was hard and there was lots of people who would rather spend their time and money on doing something else. But I think that like recently, since I guess we've put products on the market in the millions and have kind of like had successes kind of like in those legislations coming through, it's shown lots of people that this is a worthwhile thing to kind of like solve, and that there's a big prize at the end. And so we've actually since then created the Natural Polymers Group as a bit of an industry group to represent the interest of this emerging industry, because we're stronger as an industry. And so, yes, we're reaching out to competitors. We still think that like seaweed is going to be the winner in this, but there's people who are kind of like looking at all sorts of other natural polymers, mushrooms, stream shells, kind of like agricultural waste, etc. Because those are the building blocks of nature. So that's the things that like we should be using more of. And so, yeah, we have to kind of like stay ahead, but at the same time, we need a group, because otherwise we are kind of like a bit of an anomaly.
I like that. That's such an interesting way of thinking about it, is that we need a competition to push us forward and to show their interest in this space, to make it sustainable for the long term, as well as make the impact that we need to. So many people be like, oh, I'm the first, I'm the monopoly, let me own it. It doesn't really help sometimes, especially in what you're doing. So such a different way of thinking about it. And then when I listen to you going through a black box process to achieve that certification in Europe, the question I'd ask you at that point in time was that like a major highlight to you? I'm curious, if I was to compare it to winning the Earthshot Prize, what was that one like?
I think like both highlights, definitely. The Earthshot Prize was kind of like incredibly kind of like public, whereas I think that the Dutch government kind of like decision was something that we celebrated internally, but it felt like we were kind of like the only ones to know about this and that it was going to be significant. So it was really interesting. It was kind of like the opposite kind of like types of events, but both were kind of like very important in our kind of like in our journey. But obviously, like winning the Earthshot Prize, that was quite kind of like quite something. Getting the prize like from this initiative from Prince William. I'm French. I didn't really care too much about like the royals before, but now I actually see that like it's quite incredible the platform that they have and that they use for talking about sustainability. So I am very much kind of like pro, and I see how they are so influential in getting momentum and like more and more people to care about this. So it's quite an amazing thing to be part of, frankly. And obviously kind of like this ability to attract so many talents that have their own kind of like audiences. So when the prize was kind of like announced to us by David Beckham himself, we were like, oh my God, this is crazy.
Were you surprised?
Yeah, I mean like, because basically like the beforehand, so you really don't know until the live kind of like announcement on stage.
Yeah, I see it. I watch it on TV, yeah.
Proper kind of like a proper surprise till the end. And they had like, someone had like let slip that beforehand they do filming on location to try to kind of like create a little bit of like a video that like showcase the solution in a bit more detail if you're one of the winner. And we'd heard that like if they film long enough piece, there's more like most likely you're going to be the winner, because they have enough kind of like of the script and of the kind of like different moments to make a 5 minute video. Whereas if they have like just snippets and they've only kind of like taped you for long enough to do in like a 2 minute blurb, then it's just like the trailer and you're probably not going to win. And so we were convinced, because of the script and like trying to kind of like put together how long the edit was going to be, that we were not going to win because they hadn't filmed enough material. But actually they did like a really good edit with a relatively kind of like small amount, and so we were like, no way. So it was quite fun. Like leading up to this, we had lots of kind of like moments of kind of like trying to read from like the people of the Earthford Prize whether there was a hint of something, but they really didn't let anything slip. It was well played, which made it so much more special, because I think like there's very few moments that feel like a celebration in the startup kind of like journey. Even like a funding round, everyone imagined that it's like really exciting. It's the most dragged out kind of like anticlimactic thing, because you've been working on this deal for like months and months, lawyers picking on like the last details and so on. The signature, it's all done like on DocuSign before things get ready. So there's not like a moment where you're like, this was the moment. Whereas when you've got the BBC cameras like filming you and you're figuring out live kind of like whether you've won or not, that is a moment that happens like this. And I think those are very, very rare.
I think it's such a amazing thing, I guess, for you and the whole company to be able to have those different perspectives, from being on TV and getting that international audience recognition to achieving amazing things and celebrating internally. And it's interesting how the milestones and the metrics that are so important sometimes are the ones that are most hidden. Mm-hmm. But that's part of the game, and you have to know how to celebrate both the big moments and the small moments, regardless of how they come. I was curious, like your first product, Oho, which was like this flexible, biodegradable packaging where people can eat it. When you decided to come up with that, did people take you seriously, or was it like, what are you playing at?
Yeah, I mean, like that was the foundational kind of like product that got us started. If you imagine, it's like it looks like a bubble filled with water or juice or like energy drink or whatever it is, and the membrane is made from seaweed, and you can eat the whole thing, a bit like a cherry tomato that would be filled with liquid. And it's like a super interesting, attention grabbing, contrarian proposition, because edible packaging, if you're going to eat it, what is it packaged by? There's all sorts of kind of like weird meta questions like this. When you think about it, like the inspiration initially was fruits do that. Like you can eat the peel of a fruit, but also you can not eat them and throw them away, and nature knows how to deal with that material, no problem. So that was a bit the standard for us. Like if nature can like build these materials for packaging, can we learn how to make packaging that feels exactly like nature? Fruit, like a fruit form factor. And so that's when we learned about seaweed and started to kind of like develop the first kind of like formulation. And yeah, people took us seriously enough that like it went viral online. People were really interested in this. That was kind of like, that's the thing that like got us started. Like we were just like in the kitchen with very little intention to build an established company out of this. But seeing the reaction of people, we were like, wow, this is actually something that like really hits a nerve. Maybe we need to kind of like develop it further. But as I said, like for a year of fundraising, no investor wanted to kind of like write a check, because it was weird. It was kind of like unconventional. It was very hard to imagine that this was going to lead to maybe other product lines, and that it was going to be kind of like the zeitgeist was going to be kind of like good enough for plastic. It was before Blue Planet kind of like talked about plastic, before the straw in the nose of the turtle, all of the kind of like big emotional plastic response hadn't happened yet. So yeah, people took it semi seriously, I guess.
That, I want to call it creative edge genius that you had creating that product. And you obviously mentioned creativity is something that's important to you. How do you keep that alive when you're moving from having a startup mindset to like a scaling and growing business like you have now?
Yeah, I think it's hard because at the same time, like, you need to focus, you need to finish things. I think, like, Rodrigo and I were really good at starting things, so we've had to surround ourselves with lots of people who are good at finishing things. So I think that, like, you need to find the right balance. Also, we've had to kind of, like, be a little bit more rigorous with our process, so not everything can, like, be immediately jumped in and, like, dedicated resources at and so on. We have more of a process. We've actually created, like, an innovation team, and we have an amazing innovation director who came from the same masters where we met, really gets kind of, like, this approach. And so she's now spending her time very wisely with that team on exploring those kind of, like, those non-linear breakthrough kind of, like, propositions. But the majority of our resources is going into scaling the things that work, and so it means sometimes having to kind of, like, turn off a bit the tap on, like, creativity and focusing on, like, the thing that actually is like business critical KPIs that, yeah, that just makes everything possible.
So where do you then pour that creative energy? Because it goes somewhere. You can't just turn it off completely. What do you do to actually help you get it out of your system?
I have my kind of, like, creativity outlets on the weekends. I'm actually quite kind of, like, into quite niche things like generative art and generative music. Don't ask me how I got into this, but basically, like, the idea is that you're kind of, like, co-creating either kind of, like an artwork or kind of, like, a piece of music with an external system. It's not AI, but, like, for example, for, like, generative art, it's using, like, 3D printer type of like machines, like pen plotters. So they are, like, holding a pen and they're kind of, like, drawing their own kind of, like, math-based graphic explorations. And that's a bit strange, but, like, this is the kind of things that I like to do, because within an afternoon you can start and finish a project. You can, like, just make a cool looking poster or kind of, like, a postcard, or you can, like, create like a soundscape that sounds like you're floating in space or whatever it is. Those are very short, easy to start, easy to finish projects, and they give me the satisfaction of finishing something, because otherwise, like, a startup is this kind of, like, never finishing thing. And so you need to have those, like, small kind of, like, close the loop moments. So to me, that's the way to recharge the batteries. But other people have kind of, like, other kind of, like, recharge mechanism. But that, yeah, over time, I kind of, like, fell into this around COVID times, and that's been a bit the way for my brain to refresh and reset.
You say one day we might get a leak of some tracks featuring Pierre
Yeah.
coming out online somewhere.
Probably on YouTube and Spotify, if you want to plug the links there, but, you know, it's good fun.
I like that, and I think it's always very important to have those side of things to do, because it just fills you up and fills your soul. While what used to be the fun, creative things, you can't pour into that because now it's a business. You need to have that other side too. When you think about success, how did you define it earlier on, and how do you define it now? Is it still the same, or has it changed for you?
Can you give me one second? I'm just gonna get a charger. Let's see if I'm back. Oh, it's a bit slow. Maybe a bit of lag. Can you hear me okay, or?
I can hear you. It lagged a bit, but now it's you're back.
Cool. Hopefully we'll catch up. Sorry, I was on the low battery.
That's fine. And the way this records, it's when it records on your side, it records in real time. So even though it might get it slower, it will sync itself back up, so it's fine. So when you think about success from when you first started to where you are right now, is it still the same definition that you have, or do you have have you redefined it since then?
It's a good question. I think I was talking about being a bit naive. I think that like that's something that you have a certain capital of, and it kind of like wears off over time, and so you become more and more, I guess, industry savvy or business savvy or whatever the term is, but you lose a little bit of that dreamy kind of like ambition of the beginning, which is not a bad thing. Like you can waste a lot of time with like this naive or early days kind of like approach, but as a result, I think that our ambition has always been anchored in impact. It's all about how much plastic can we actually really replace? How can we create mainstream solutions that make us avoid using plastic that might be lost in nature? And so that has never kind of like gone away. If anything, it's become more and more real and more kind of like achievable. But I think that like there's all the layers of the startup world saying like success is defined by how big is your team and how much money you're raising and how much kind of like revenue you're creating and how kind of like your gross margin is kind of like better than your competitors and all that kind of stuff, which I think is a necessary kind of like set of KPIs to drive the company in the right direction and create value. But it's also kind of like a little bit less like close to the purpose and the heart to make it kind of like the thing that you're kind of like waking up in the morning to do. So I think there's a sweet spot, and I think like we've probably kind of like dialed down a little bit on the kind of like let's naively think that everything is going to work, and we've dialed up on like this is what good business look like. And I think we have a sweet spot now, but I think it's important to kind of like check in and make sure that is still a sweet spot.
So is there anything you've had to unlearn along the way, along your journey, to help you to then get to where you are right now, when you think about Nopla, what you've built, having that mentality of this is what a good, solid, amazing business kind of looks like?
Loads of stuff. Probably like a lot of it is quite unconscious. I think my initial experience at L'Oréal was super helpful for being quite close to the plastics industry, understanding how things work in like big corporates. But for a long time, it's also like maybe been a disservice for certain aspects, because I was just assuming that this was the way to go about it, when actually there's lots of different ways to kind of like approach the problem. And I think having grads around and having people who are kind of like not coming necessarily from the industry, coming from academia, coming from different places, has been really great to have the diversity of opinion, because I felt like I had a bit the validated experience from the industry. At the same time, I had like a relatively short industry experience, and so I've had to learn how to rely more on the people who have really kind of like deep experience, 30 years of experience in the industry. And I think now we're starting to have like a really good board, people who really have kind of like seen multiple waves of things. They have the perspective. And so, yeah, you've got to learn bits from them, unlearn bits from your past to be able to do a better job.
And on that journey, then, what's helped you become a better leader? Because I said you spent 2 years in industry, then you went to study, you're running an organization, you've raised funding, you've got people reporting into you, you've got your co-founder relationship, you're leading. Yeah, you're leading on a massive international global scale. So what's helped you become a better leader to do this?
Lots of things. And like, I don't know how, like, it's a journey. Like, we're definitely still kind of like learning lots of things and doing lots of things wrong, but we've also kind of like had a lot of kind of like things in the past that were much worse, where we've kind of like learned how to approach it better. One thing that has been very helpful, we've had kind of like coaching for like co-founder coaching. So shout out to Marissa from People Untapped, who also kind of like was in the 10KSB course. But I think that's been like really amazing to have her helping us kind of like think through some things, not just like abstractly. Like, coaching can be a little bit like you're gonna find your solution yourself, and just like I'll just ask the question. And actually, like, Marissa is very pragmatic. Sometimes, like, she's just saying, this is how it gets done in most cases. What do you think about this model? This is the book where they talk about this. So a little bit more kind of like provocative than just asking questions back at you. So that's been really helpful. My wife, and I think, you know, like, really close partner, like, the role that like our partners play is like significant, because it's a lot of kind of like weight on the shoulders. So I think that like they are the like unsung heroes, because at the end of the day, when we have a crap day, we bring it back home, and like it's not always kind of like necessarily fun to deal with, but they are like super supportive. We try, in all honesty, to kind of like get feedback from the team on how we can do it better. Regularly kind of like try to kind of like do 360 feedback to try to understand what's our blind spot. And sometimes they say things that are hitting home and very true, and sometimes they're saying things where we just have to kind of like disregard it, because that's not kind of like the direction we want to go. And I think like it's also kind of like learning how to kind of like pick the things that like you think are aligned with what you want to achieve. Yeah, so those are some of the things that we've approached.
And now you're all in, you've raised, obviously you're trying to grow the organization. Where would you want to take things to? Like, what is your ideal scenario that would happen with Nopla?
Yeah, I think we still have this relatively open-ended kind of like approach to it, which will follow whatever gives us the chance of having the biggest impact at scale, which I think is a nice way of keeping things kind of like opportunistic. If it's partnering with one of the big incumbent kind of like packaging company, or like working closely with brands, or even if this was building a company for the long run that will be kind of like global, might one day kind of like float on the market. Like, those are all valid kind of like options if they serve the purpose of kind of like delivering more impact in the market than the other. So I think we are quite kind of like happy to like be guided by this. It's not just our call, we have investors and they have investors, and so like I think that there's also kind of like multiple things that enter in the discussion. But I think we're really lucky to be backed by people who believe in the impact that we can have, and it's not just a kind of like economical return that they're looking after. That's also kind of like having that beneficial kind of like new nature-based solution on the market. So yeah, I think that like that is the general thing I would say. And like for me, and I'll speak for Rodrigo, I think we're also kind of like open enough about the fact that we feel we're the best custodian of Notpla right now, but we are also kind of like happy to see if the time comes someone doing a better job than us at it. That's okay as well. I think that like what we want is this to have the most impact, and that also means that personally it could be that like we just join forces with someone else who's better at like running this when it's at the scale of replicating everywhere in the world and doing all sorts of new things. And maybe we can use our kind of like skill set on like other areas. So I think we want to make sure that like we are not just hogging this position because we feel entitled to it, but like that we feel like we're the best person right now for that job.
That's one of the things that I in speaking to you even earlier and before this, and when we met, I noticed there is a openness to being focused solely on the mission, which is around sustainability and packaging, and rather than being like, this is my company and we have to do this XYZ. like, and obviously he described it so many times all the way throughout different things, different ways and approaches you and Rodrigo have had of doing things and doing things your own way, but bringing change to the industry. And to have that, what I call the humility to not hold on to this is my company, this is my title, but more hold on to the purpose and the mission of why it was created is such a different way of looking at things. And it's for me, it's very refreshing to hear like founders talking about their companies that they've spent time, energy, effort, sacrificed so much building, but talk about it in that open and free kind of way. It makes such a massive difference.
Well, thanks. And I think, again, I really believe in diversity of kind of like approach. What works for us doesn't mean that like it's the only way to scale sustainable, like purpose-led company. I think that there's lots of kind of like examples of people who are making incredible change happen in the market by the sheer force of being stubborn and kind of like holding their ground and maybe kind of like being a little bit more the stereotypical kind of like solo founder approach. But I think for us, that's not really the place we're coming from. And so it wouldn't be authentic to us. And I think like if you're not authentic, you're not gonna last the distance. So that's a bit the way to approach it.
Well, one thing you have been all the way throughout this interview has been authentic, which I very much appreciate, bringing that reality of what it's like building and growing a sustainable business, the ebbs and flows, the different challenges that you go through, the hidden things that people don't see and recognize. But it's all part of being a founder, and you're like, this is what I bring to the world, and this is important to me, and therefore we need to go through that journey. So just thank you for coming on and sharing all the information about how you can connect with Pierre, how you can connect with Nuplar, how you might be able to be in a company you might be listening to, like, actually my company might need some sustainable packaging. Connect with them and get involved, because the more the organizations can lean in, the better it's going to be as we try and change the world and change the environment that we're living in to make it more sustainable. So appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for shining a light on some of those aspects that get talked about a bit less than the usual business pitch.
No problem at all. It's the Everyday Leadership. We will see you soon.